So tonight, as you've gathered, we are continuing in this series looking at Elijah, God's man in a hostile environment. And I was going to refer to the hostile environment, but James has already done that. And I think much of what Gilbert said probably replaces what I've said. So I'll just go away and have a cup of tea. The other thought that occurred to me was that I might deliver the sermon in French tonight, because I was speaking to someone after this morning's service, and they were saying to me that they listened more intently because of the accent, but there are major problems with delivering it in French, so we're not going to do that. Instead, we're going to focus on what happened to Elijah after the triumph in Mount Carmel, where God's power was displayed. And that was a direct contrast to the impotence of Baal. And the people of Israel responded to God's power, and the three-year drought was broken, and everything looked as if it was falling into place. But in reality, everything hadn't changed. And I said last week that the contest for the soul of Israel was not over, because as soon as Jezebel heard what had happened, she acted to protect her hold on power. And I was reminded of the phrase that Margaret Thatcher used at a conference speech when she said, "The lady is not for turning." No matter what the evidence might say, Jezebel is not for turning. And almost as an aside, I don't know if you noticed when Maureen was reading the passage, but when Ahab is relaying the events of Mount Carmel to Jezebel, he puts the responsibility for everything onto Elijah. Ahab, the king of Israel, doesn't mention God's role in those events at all. But the way Jezebel sees things, Elijah is the problem. So Elijah has to go. And go he does. And that's what we're going to look at tonight. First of all, we'll spend a wee bit of time thinking what's going on with Elijah. We'll then look at some similarities between what happens here with Elijah and some of the stories about Moses from earlier in the Old Testament. And then we're going to look quite carefully at Elijah's encounter with the Lord on Mount Horeb. So what's going on with Elijah? Well, before I get into that, I think this is one of those passages from the Bible that reinforces the integrity of Scripture. Because we see a picture painted here that would have been easy for the writer to skip over. Remember that the author of 1 Kings earlier on had described the reign of a king in no more than a paragraph or two. So this episode could have been skipped over, but it wasn't. And we see Elijah, warts and all. And I think there is a tendency, certainly among some commentators, to jump to hasty assessments of Elijah's role. But I think before we fall into that trap, it would be good to remember the words that are ascribed to the Danish philosopher Søren Kierkegaard. Actually, this is a paraphrase of what he said. And he said that life can only be understood backwards, but it must be lived forwards. And by laying out for us Elijah's emotion and reaction as he lived his life forward, the author of the Book of Kings gives us the opportunity to learn from his experience and hopefully apply some of those lessons to our lives. Now, Elijah's hopes, to all intents and purposes, had been dashed. After the experience on Mount Carmel, he expected things to change. He thought things had already changed. Instead, he finds that his life is threatened, and he doesn't see a single person supporting him. So after running down the mountain, he now runs away to the desert. he swiftly goes from being elated to being deflated. He feels alone, lost, and afraid. So there's a lot of stuff for Elijah to process. And as he goes about this, we see him pretty much following in the footsteps of Moses. There is no doubt whatsoever in my mind that the writer of 1 Kings intends us to see very clear parallels between Elijah and Moses. The first thing is the reference to 40 days and 40 nights. That's how long it took Elijah to travel to Mount Horeb. Well, in the book of Exodus, we read that Moses entered the cloud as he went up on the mountain, and he stayed on the mountain 40 days and 40 nights. And of course, that will remind us as well of the 40 days and nights that Jesus spent in the wilderness being tempted right after his baptism. These long periods of isolation are periods of testing. And the next similarity with Moses is around where he went. Elijah, we see at Mount Horeb. We read about Moses at Mount Sinai. But most scholars believe that these are different names for the same mountain, reinforcing the parallel between the two. And then there is a desire stated that they want to die. In verse 4 of 1 Kings, we read Elijah saying, "I have had enough, Lord. Take my life. I am no better than my ancestors." Well, in the book of Numbers, we read about Moses, one of his ancestors, saying, "I cannot carry all these people by myself. The burden is too heavy for me. If this is how you are going to treat me, please go ahead and kill me right now." But for me, the clear and decisive parallel comes with the encounter that they have in the cave or around the cave. These are rare occasions in the Old Testament when God reveals his presence directly to a human and interacts with them. So in Exodus chapter 33, we read that the Lord said to Moses, "There is a place near me where you may stand on a rock. When my glory passes by, I will put you in a cleft in the rock and cover you with my hand until I have passed by. Then I will remove my hand and you will see my back, but my face must not be seen." These encounters are real privileges for Moses and Elijah and key to the ministries that they would fulfill. But I want to turn now and pay close attention to this encounter that Elijah has with God. See, Elijah ends up in the desert where he calls out, he laments to God about his circumstances, but he hasn't been deserted by God. He's sustained by an angel. He's also encouraged to proceed. And I think we can view this as guidance to Elijah that he's on the right path, maybe even authorizing him to go on to God's mountain, to Mount Horeb. And when he arrives at Horeb and goes into the cave, he has this encounter with the Lord. Now, there's an interesting part to this story about questions and answers, and we'll come back to that shortly. But right now, I want to focus on a tricky Hebrew phrase that's at the heart of this section. And the phrase is translated quite differently in different versions of our Bibles. We will all be familiar with some form of these words, but I want to look at them in a variety of different ways tonight. So the last phrase in verse 12, the NIV, which we read, describes it as a gentle whisper. The English Standard Version refers to it as the sound of a low whisper. The King James Version, which is certainly the one that keeps recurring to me, is rendered as a still, small voice. And then the New Revised Standard Version describes it as a sound of sheer silence. These are quite different translations and carry different meanings for us. And how did we get here? Well, as this morning we learned some French and sang it, this evening we're going to learn some Hebrew, but not sing it. There are three Hebrew words here. And for those of you who don't read Hebrew, they are kol, dak, demama. Kol can be translated as voice or sound or noise. Dak can mean thin or small. And demama can mean silence, whisper, or calm. And you can really join the dots between any of these three columns to try and come up with a meaning for what kol, dak, demama means. Because each of these possible translations are used differently in different contexts throughout the Old Testament. So clearly, this is complicated. And to make sense of it, translators try and look at the context and work out what fits best. So that's what I'm going to do tonight, despite the fact that I don't speak any Hebrew. I'm going to try and make sense of it in the context. Because this revelation of God, this still small voice, or this sound like a low whisper, is sandwiched between two identical questions that are asked of Elijah and two identical responses that he gives. So we need to look at what is the question that's being asked. And the Lord asks Elijah, "What are you doing here?" But that's a question which can be understood in a number of different ways. Some commentators see it as a rebuke. Why are you in this place when you should be somewhere else? Others see it as an invitation. Tell me why you have come here. What do you want from me? Or it could be a challenge to Elijah. Do you know what your purpose is? Are you clear about what I have called you to do? And Elijah's identical response to this question, when it's asked twice, seems to indicate that he still hasn't fully processed the events relating to his current situation. So if we piece all of that information together, how can we make sense of this passage? Well, I'm going to offer you my opinion, my view of where I think Elijah is. I think the question is posed as a challenge. I think that even after 40 days in the wilderness, Elijah's not really clear about what's going on. On Mount Carmel, he saw God act powerfully through the fire. And I wonder if he expected that to be the way that Ahab and Jezebel and Israel would be brought back into line. And here on Mount Horeb, he finds that God is not in the fire, or the wind, or the earthquake. And I think God is indicating to Elijah and to us that the grand display is not God's normal operating procedure. Elijah is being given a unique insight into how God reveals himself. So with all of that in mind, my preferred translation is probably to go down the way that the New Revised Standard Version goes and talk about a sound of sheer silence, a sound of thin silence. I like the idea of thin because it raises for me that notion from Celtic Christianity about thin places, places where the gap between earth and heaven is at its smallest. But each of you will have your own way of relating to this text. And I think how you view these words may well depend where you are on life's journey. Walter Brueggemann, the Old Testament commentator, says that the familiar King James Version rendering of still small voice suggests a sound that is soft and intimate. More recent opinion suggests no voice, no sound, but an eerie silence laden with a sense of holiness. And one of the reasons that I like that idea of it being a sheer silence is that meeting one-to-one with the active, personal, present God of Israel is an awe-inspiring experience. It's an experience that leads Elijah to cover his face. It's also a life-changing event for Elijah, because as we heard right at the end and deliberately stopped mid-verse so that you come back in a couple of weeks' time to find out what happens next, is that Elijah goes back into the danger zone. Last week, I used a phrase by Martin Buber, talking about miracles as abiding astonishment. And I believe that this encounter, a direct encounter reserved for a select few, would abide with Elijah because of his astonishment, his wonder, his sense of awe. And I see this silence that greets Elijah as something that penetrates and searches and examines his soul. And whenever I think about passages like this that are really about the holiness of God, I turn to one of my favorite writers of all time, a Jewish theologian called Abraham Joshua Heschel. I love the way that he uses words. And one of the words that he uses frequently when he's talking about God is the word ineffable. And if, like me, you need to look that up every time you read it, here's what the definition is. It's an adjective meaning too great or extreme to be expressed or described in words. And I think that Elijah's encounter with God falls into the category of ineffable, beyond words, too great to be described. And it was experienced, I think, in sheer silence. So to try and pull that together, I came across another saying of Soren Kierkegaard's that I think may or may not be helpful. It certainly helped me. He wrote that it is good for a person to withdraw from the turmoil of the world. For in life, either the depressing or the elevating impression is too dominant for a true balance to come about. I think that Elijah had to learn that he wasn't responsible for those amazing events on Mount Carmel. But he also had to realize that a desperate death in the desert or at Jezebel's hands was not his destiny. He had to learn, or rather relearn, that he was God's servant. And his service would conclude when God decided it would conclude, not when things seemed to be going badly. You don't really have the opportunity to resign as a prophet of the Lord. And even if Elijah still couldn't make sense of what was going on, God clarifies it for him in verse 15 by instructing him to go back. And we will look at that in a couple of weeks' time. But that leaves me with the question, what are we to make of this story? Well, I think it's helpful for us to be reminded that God chooses to reveal himself in the thin, sheer silence, far more frequently than in the earth-shattering wind, or the earthquake, or the fire. Now, of course, we have a significant advantage that Elijah didn't have. We can approach God differently, thanks to Jesus' earthly ministry and the gift of the Spirit. But while we can call God Father, we still need to maintain an appropriate sense of God's holiness, an appropriate sense of reverence. And I think our job is to put ourselves in the position where we can be prompted by the voice of God, whether in silence or in words, in our encounters with our Creator. And sometimes we need to learn to be silent before God, because when we give up words, we stop trying to control the situation. So tonight I want to encourage us all to learn to listen more and to work at becoming better listeners. And I had to finish with one thought from Abraham Joshua Heschel tonight, where he says, to become aware of the ineffable is to part company with words, which is a good point for me to stop speaking.